The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's Donal Kavanagh standing in for Greg on the programme this morning. As we say, some interesting things happening on the programme this week. Tell you more about that as this programme goes on. We have, as ever, a lot to talk about on the show today. So do please stick with us. But as we always say, no matter how much we have prepared, no matter how much we have on our agenda, that all gets put to one side based on your comments and your perceptions and your perspectives and your contributions, because it's your input that makes this show what this show is. And what this show is, we like to think, is the best show of its kind in the northwest of Ireland and indeed beyond. If you want to call us, you can do so. It's 074 91 25000, 00353 74 91 25000, if you're outside of the dialing area. Anya taking your calls, and Donna Marie as well. Donna Marie also producing the show this morning. You can text us or WhatsApp us. 086 60 25000 is the number there. You can make contact via social media at Highland Radio on Twitter. It's Highland Hub on Facebook. We're also on Instagram, Snapchat and all other manner of social media doodads. You can watch the show live, of course. We're broadcasting live on our Facebook pages, the Highland Radio and Highland Radio News and Sport Facebook pages. You can also watch the show on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. So if you want to see me in all my non-glory, you can absolutely do so. And what's really good about that, actually, is when we take calls in on Zoom, as we do frequently over the course of the programme, you can actually watch the Zoom calls as they unfold as well. So we suddenly become a TV programme all of a sudden, which is very interesting and gratifying. And from my point of view, the great thing means I can just put the screen on the person to whom I am speaking to, and that is all the better for everyone. Let's start with the papers. It's a Tuesday morning, which means we have the Tuesday edition of the Donegal Democrat. Save Our School, Gaelscoil Fights Back. Parents, staff and pupils of Gaelscoil na gCaoimh Maistre have mounted a determined fight back against the decision to withhold funding for the new school building. Siobhan McNamara writes that after 24 years in prefabs and numerous delays, all stages had been approved, and we've had this on news and on the show indeed over the past number of weeks on a number of occasions. Everything was ready to rock, and suddenly, because of a lack of funds, it was decided a number of projects across the country would be stalled. Na gCaoimh Maistre is one of those projects which has been stalled, when the local community are saying, we've waited long enough, we're not taking this lying down. And there's a lovely perspective on this. There was a recent announcement from the minister that free books would be provided for school children. And there is a lovely picture of one of the pupils and her teacher standing outside the prefabs with a big sign saying, where is our school? And a big stack of school books. And they're effectively saying, thanks for the school books, minister. Where are we going to put them? Because we don't have a school to put them in. And that's a very clever way of drawing attention to the plight there. Front of the Derry Journal, you'll have heard this on news yesterday. MICA redress poll pledge. 84% of homeowners surveyed by the MICA Action Group say they will vote in the next election based on how well or poorly the government has put in place solid measures to commit to 100% redress. MAG chairperson Lisa Hone outlined how multiple submissions have been made to government in relation to draft regulations, and many, many issues still to be resolved there. Irish Independent this morning. Main story, state sitting on enough land for more than 60,000 homes. You'll have heard this on news with Michaela over the course of the morning. Affordable housing sites spanning 10 counties. Philip Ryan outlines the Land Development Agency has identified state-owned property in 5 cities and 5 regional centres. Letterkenny, one of those regional centres. Sligo, one of those centres as well, actually, where the state could hand land over to the Land Development Agency and it could get on with building homes. And certainly people will be looking at that with interest. Long discussion in Donegal County Council Chamber yesterday, by coincidence you'll have heard Councillor Jerry McMonagle on news today as well, and the council discussing the homeless plan and how Donegal County Council is to tackle both emergency homelessness in the county, and also lots of discussion too about the provision of social housing and the eviction ban. The council, as a number of councils have been doing, the council did pass a motion calling for the eviction ban to be maintained. That motion moved by Councillor Albert Doherty, the motion was passed. Now, whether the government is going to listen to what Donegal County Council has to say and change its own mind, that's questionable to say the least. But the council still took that decision yesterday, and the issue of the eviction van still very much a live issue in Donegal County Council and in chambers, I suspect, right across the country. I suspect there's very similar motions being moved pretty much at local authority level in every county in this country at this point in time, because this is one of the real national issues, the effects of which are being felt literally everywhere. The other story on the front of the Independent this morning, Kerry Baby, key DNA from close relative of baby John, DNA at the centre of the Kerry Baby case, was voluntarily handed over by a person who Gardaí believed to be a close relative of the deceased baby. This was a breakthrough which prompted the investigation team to make the high-profile arrests of a couple in Kerry last week. Now, as we heard and we discussed this yesterday, even if the parentage of baby John has been proven, and it could take some time before that is achieved, obviously DNA samples have been taken, they're awaiting the analysis of those samples, and they're going to be analysed, believe you me, they're going to be analysed more carefully than any DNA sample was ever analysed, because this case has been so controversial and has been so awful for so long in this country that nothing is going to be done on the Kerry Baby's case and on the case of baby John until every I is dotted and every T is crossed three times, triple checked three times, and then checked again another four times just to be sure. Also a picture of Nathan Collins, his last gasp header on goal that was saved by the French goalkeeper last night in the closing stages of Ireland's match against France, that could so easily have been a 1-1 draw. And after questions being asked of the Irish soccer team in recent times, I think a lot of those questions were answered very, very forcefully and very, very comprehensively in the Aviva Stadium last night. I know a number of people had travelled up to the game from Donegal, not least, actually, you'll recall we spoke to Brendan Devaney yesterday previewing the DL debate, and Brendan was en route to Dublin with his nephew at the time for the match, and I hope he and his nephew had an absolute blast. I'm sure that was real edge of the seat stuff to be sitting at, and a lot of people saying this morning how proud they are to say they're Irish fans, because there is certainly that team has got its mojo back, and long may that remain the case. Big worry now, of course, is that can they keep up that momentum and can they keep up that strength against the teams like Greece? Because, you know, if they can replicate that against Greece, then, you know what? They could be going places. A photograph on the front of the Irish Times, actually, from the other angle. And it shows, actually, how close that goal was. It just shows the French goalkeeper, Mike Mannion, making that save that denied Nathan Collins the equaliser in the 90th minute. Also, on the front of the Irish Times, the main story, again, review finds scope for 60,000 homes on state land. Statutory inquiry into Defence Forces abuse likely. A report will be published on the basis of claims of bullying, harassment and sexual abuse of Defence Force members, and that full statutory inquiry should be established. That's according to the Independent Review Group, which was established in 2021. The report is understood to make for difficult reading and to detail patterns of inappropriate and illegal behaviour within the military. Also, in international news, Mark Weiss in Jerusalem writes that Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, has delayed controversial plans to weaken the judiciary following mass protests across the country and a general strike. He said he had ordered a time out on the proposal. Let's look at the Irish Daily Mail this morning. The Irish Daily Mail, as coalition faces a crucial confidence motion, the supply of new houses has slumped by almost 20%. New blow on home building is the main headline there. The story by Craig Hughes and Brian Mahan. And they basically say the coalition has been dealt a fresh blow ahead of tomorrow's crucial confidence motion. The supply of new homes has slumped by almost 20%, around 6,000 fewer new homes available than at the same time last year. And given that the whole confidence motion in the government is being sparked by the response to the housing crisis, and in particular the refusal to maintain the evictions ban for those in rental accommodation, that will not be music to the government's ears. Now, we are hearing this morning in other areas that a lot of members of the regional independents and people that the government are dependent on for support, they are indicating that they will not be supporting the Labour motion. So one would have thought the government is likely to survive this vote this week, and it will keep on going. Now, if it keeps on going as a limping lame duck, or it keeps on going with a huge groundswell of support behind it, remains to be seen. I suspect the former may more be the case, and certainly the vote will not be as comprehensive, I suspect, as the eviction ban vote was last week. We'll see how that pans out. Also on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, cancer test backlog due to staff shortages. There is a significant backlog in cancer test results due to a shortage of medical scientists. That means some anxious patients are waiting up to 6 months to get potentially life-altering test results. That's according to the Academy of Clinical Science and Laboratory Medicine. Its president, Bernie Quirk, said it's a major concern that 13% of medical scientist posts are unfilled. And we're hearing that right across the health sector at present, so many unfilled posts, and that is a matter of serious concern. Irish Daily Star this morning. Killer kept Annie bag as souvenir. It's DNA jackpot, according to a top cold case cop, and Larry Murphy must be quizzed. Annie McCarrick's leather bag, we're told, could be crucial to determining what happened to her. That case was upgraded, you'll recall, last Friday, I think it was, from a missing persons case to a murder case. So one can only assume that Gardaí have got new perspectives and some new information to hand, and we'll see how that one pans out. Also on the front of the Star, on a side bar there, Bailey to be evicted from home. Writer Ian Bailey is said to be evicted from his West Cork home. The 64-year-old, who was questioned twice over the murder in 1996 of Sophie Toussaint Duplantier, but was never charged, received a motion to quit before Christmas. It'll be enforced with the imminent ending of the eviction ban. Looking at the Irish Sun this morning, and that's the main story. Bailey's eviction hell, Ian's homeless fears as ban ends. That story there on the front of the Irish Sun. Also, for a fingertip from Joy, another very good photograph there of the French keeper making that save, which denied Ireland an equaliser in the dying minutes of that game against France in the Aviva Stadium last night. And finally, the Irish Daily Mirror, Kenny's heroes feeling bleu, miracle save breaks Irish hearts, and ex-cop's theory, killer took missing Annie's bag, former detective believes it was kept as a trophy after her murder. That's Alan Bailey, who had been probing the case at the time. They're the papers. That's what's happening in the world of our newspapers this morning. As we said, if you want to make contact with us, you can do so 086 65 000 for your text, or no, 086 60 25 000, excuse me, for your text or WhatsApp messages, 074 91 25 000 if you want to give us a ring on the phone. We'll be back after this short break. You may well have heard over the course of the day that the Donegal Donkey Sanctuary is appealing for funds and has launched a major drive because they are running short of money, not least because of the impact of a very popular recent film. Let's discuss this and other issues with Danny Curran, who's the manager of the sanctuary. Danny, good morning.
Good morning, Donal, and thank you for having us on your show this morning.
It's our pleasure, Danny, and we know that the sanctuary has been there for many, many years now and has done some great work. One of the things you're finding, Danny, and let's take this one first because I find this somewhat fascinating. Anyone who's seen The Banshees of Inisherin will know that Colin Farrell's character has a donkey of whom he is very fond. Don't want to give any spoilers to people that haven't sort of watched the film yet, but the donkey sort of features in the plot of the film. And you reckon that's actually led to an increase in people looking for donkeys as pets, and that in turn has led to more donkeys coming to you?
Yeah, well, I haven't actually seen the film myself, but I've heard enough about it. Like, and Colin Farrell apparently has this donkey, Jenny, and a lot of people look at that there, but what they don't realise is that's a highly trained donkey, a very calm, quiet donkey, and they think then that this would be an ideal pet for a child or maybe for themselves to have. Now, there is legal requirements. You have to have an equine number, an acre of ground, a stable. And a lot of people sort of rush out, buy these donkeys, and the next thing they realise they don't have all the things that they need, and they don't have the time, and they don't have the skills. Now, one of the things I will say is, if you're thinking of buying a donkey, come to the sanctuary, talk to us. We'll take you through all the steps and everything that's there. And maybe you'll think this is for you, and maybe you'll realise you don't have the, you know, the proper equipment or the training for to do that.
How many donkeys do you have on site at the moment?
We are feeding directly 98 donkeys at the minute, and to date, we have over 800 rehomed, and we have, I was just checking there a wee while ago, we have 37 donkeys waiting to come in that we don't have room for.
And presumably, when you rehome them, you will rehome them to people who are responsible. You're going to be very careful to vet them to make sure that that donkey is going to a good home and that all the criteria you've outlined there are met, and that the most important one of all is met, that that donkey is going to go to a home where it's going to be cared for and it's going to be loved.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of rehoming rules, and some people contact us and they say that we possibly have too many rules. But what you have to bear in mind is a lot of the donkeys come to us and they've had a hard life and they've been starved and they've had a lot of cruelty. So we want to make very sure that when they move on from us that, you know, they're going to a proper home. And the other thing is we never lose ownership of them. Even though somebody fosters the donkey, it always remains that it's still under the care of Donegal Donkey Sanctuary.
Yeah. In terms of the actual cost of keeping a donkey, when you take a donkey into the sanctuary, you're not just taking a donkey that you have to feed a bit of hay to, you're taking in a donkey that's going to incur veterinary bills, may need comprehensive care if that donkey's been abused, and you're taking on the responsibility for every aspect of that donkey's well-being, and that's going to go way, way beyond just chucking a bit of hay into a trough.
Yeah, if we take in a stallion, it has to be gelded. You know, you've got other costs, farrier costs, the vet costs. We even have to employ an equine dentist to make sure that their teeth are looked after properly. You've got worming costs. You know, there's a lot of people will say to me, oh, you'll squeeze in one more donkey. But what they don't realise is even, like, we have to microchip them, passport them. All the legal requirements have to be met. And then, you know, that donkey could be here for 2 or 3 years to get it tamed down and adjusted and ready to go to a new home.
It's clear, Danny, that you and the family and others involved with the sanctuary have a great love of the animals, but what you don't have is a bottomless pocket to match that love with. You've got to have funding, you've got to have support. How are you managing to fund it at the moment, and what sort of pressures are you coming under because of the extra workload and because of the fact that there are more and more donkeys now in need of help and in need of sanctuary?
Well, we've been here for a good number of years, Donald, so we do have a following of supporters. But because of the pandemic and the cost of living crisis and, you know, the spiraling costs of diesel and even veterinary medicines have gone up in price, you know, a lot of things are there. So, we're just finding it harder and harder, and there is more donkeys. You know, you've got house repossessions, people losing land, people immigrating. All them things factor in, and we end up with more animals, and it's just getting tougher and tougher. And as you say, we don't have a bottomless pit. We have to work with what we have. Like, what a lot of people don't realise is we are actually like a fully functioning farm. We've got a tractor, a loader, a quad, and all them things need to be maintained, looked after. You know, but unlike other farms, we don't sell an end product. You know, we take in the donkeys, we repair them, make them better, tend to all their needs, and then we rehome them out and we just wait for the next one to come along, and there's always plenty more to come along. So it's getting harder and harder all the time.
And I presume you're taking donkeys in from far more than just the county of Donegal. They're probably coming to you at this stage from far and wide, because you have that reputation for being a good sanctuary and for being an area where a donkey can be safe.
2 weeks ago I was in Kilkenny lifting 3 donkeys, and you know, like we try to work from Dublin to Galway North, but, you know, it just depends where they come up and, how desperate the situation is. And we work through other organisations as well. So sometimes, you know, you could have an organisation that's been called out to pick up 3 horses and there's a donkey there as well. And we don't have the facilities for horses or dogs, and they don't have the facilities for donkeys. So we step in then and take that donkey off these other organisations as well.
So there's a whole network nationwide of support organisations, and you're at its centre.
Well, you know, we do our best, Donal. That's the handiest way to say it. Like, you know, we can't solve every problem that's out there to do with donkeys, but, you know, we try. That's all we can do.
In terms, Danny, of the way people can support you, obviously you have one-off events, but you've launched an online funding campaign now, and how can people give you support if they so choose to do?
Well, if you go to our Facebook page, there's links there to the GoFundMe campaign, or you can go to our website. I think there's a link on Facebook to our website. You can donate there, or you can call to the sanctuary, visit the donkeys, and make a donation while you're here.
Yeah, and, you know, another caller has said, the cost of living is hitting everyone. Someone's saying, and look, as they say, much as people would like to support you, sometimes they just can't because they just don't have, the resources to actually do that. And, another caller saying, look, plenty of us have donkeys, but there's no collecting money for us all year. Well, I think that's a fair enough point. If you have a donkey and you're keeping a donkey, that's absolutely your own business. But what Danny and his colleagues are doing are trying to take donkeys in and make them safe when others have abandoned them. And I think it's fair to say, Danny, you have, 97 that you're feeding at the moment with another 35 outstanding that you could take into the sanctuary right now.
Yeah, there's always a queue of donkeys waiting to come to us. I would love if we could wave a magic wand, buy more land, build more stables, and be able to solve that problem. But we just have to take everything one step at a time. We're here now 12 years, and we have a full facility built here. It has to. We need more facilities. Yeah. But as I say, the pandemic, the cost of living crisis, that just sprung up and has set us very, very far back, and we just have to try and come forward from that again.
Another caller is saying, look, how can we donate? We'd love to help. Well, as you said, go onto Facebook or just go and search Donegal Donkey Sanctuary. That'll bring you to the Facebook page, the website, and ultimately the GoFundMe page. Danny, thanks indeed for speaking to us this morning. We wish you well, and well done on all you've done up to now, because I know and I have had the pleasure of meeting you and some others involved over the years, and I know the great work that's done, and I know the love that's behind that work, and it's very important that it's underwritten by love, and I think there is no doubt about it that the Donkey Sanctuary in Donegal is a place where animals will find love, and that may be, particularly to an animal that's been abused, that's as important as the food and the water sometimes.
Yeah, thank you for having us on, Donal. It's great to get a chance to promote our work.
Yep.
And one thing I always say to people say it's work. I enjoy what I do. I love animals, and I find every day coming here to be very, very easy to do. We do deal with some bad cases and some terrible sights, but most of our work is very enjoyable.
Danny, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure. You take care.
Thank you.
That's Danny there from the Donkey Sanctuary in Lifford. Caller says, regarding the Donkey Sanctuary, glad that's clarified. Initially, I thought you were referring to the council office in Lifford. So says the caller. We'll say no more and move on, I think, at this point. Another caller says, Danny and his family are amazing people. I would urge anyone to support them with a donation if they can at all. Thank you, Donegal Donkey Sanctuary, for all that you do. Okay, I'm telling you what we're going to do now. We are going to have a discussion in a few moments about the promotion of job offerings through the GAA. It's an interesting concept. We'll be speaking to somebody about that in just a moment. And of course, we'll have our Garda Community Information slot later in the programme. That's coming up at around about 8-9 minutes past 10 or thereabouts. So we'll be doing that later on in the show, as I say. Also, because tomorrow the show is coming from Brussels, and as I say, more about that over the course of the programme. Because tomorrow is coming from Brussels, it means our usual Wednesday slot with Kieran O'Donnell Business Matters will take place today instead. So we'll have Business Matters this morning at around about 11:30 rather than tomorrow morning. Now, also want to talk about a business issue now, because Kevin Meehan is the Business Development Manager with the GAA, and I'm delighted to say Kevin is joining us now on Zoom to discuss a rather interesting idea that's been promoted by the organisation. Kevin, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having us on.
It is our pleasure, Kevin. You're promoting jobs through the GAA, the idea being that there are businesses in local areas that have jobs to be filled. The GAA has access to a large network of young people, many of whom will be seeking employment. And let's be honest, many of whom will want to stay in the local area, and the GAA want them to stay in the local area to play for their club, to play for their parish, and hopefully ultimately to play for their county. And one of the ways of doing that is to try and ensure that jobs that are available locally goes to people within the organisation. It's a very interesting concept.
Yeah, thanks very much. I suppose it's important to say, just when you mention the business development manager title with the GAA, GAAworks.ie is our business. We're as such a private business, separate from the official GAA, if you like, but still working in the whole area, obviously, of GAA. So, yeah, as you say, what we're trying to achieve is, I suppose, to make people and particular members of GAA clubs across the country aware of the great opportunities that there are within local communities in every county, in the hope that it will keep people connected to their community, living in their community and working in their community.
From the point of view of what's being done, and we know there was so much discussion in the past about immigration and about communities being decimated, and one of the ways that traditionally got sort of exemplified, as it were, was in the fact that local football teams were decimated, local hurling teams were decimated in hurling counties, and you had areas where parishes and clubs at times could not put teams on a pitch anymore because there weren't enough young local people left in that area. Now, we're told so often that there are jobs to be found, and a lot of the time people don't necessarily know where to find them. So this may be a way of addressing that particular issue, that people in their own local area can find work in their own local area.
Definitely, and that's exactly what we are trying to achieve. So I suppose our website, gaaworks.ie, allows a business to advertise not only their product or service, but also any career opportunities that they have. And it allows them to specify the area that the job is in, and then the searcher on our website, or the applicant, if you like, would see where those jobs are listed by an easy-to-use filter that lets them check what county it's in, what job category it's in, and see the options that are available. So at the moment, we have there's 142 businesses registered on our platform, and there's 178 live career opportunities there. So and that ranges from apprenticeship opportunities to part-time jobs right up to full-time senior positions. So we're really trying to place an emphasis that there are, I suppose, a huge variety of job opportunities out there, not only for more experienced people, but for young people who may be leaving college, maybe leaving second level school and have no interest in going to college. So there's certainly a big interest in, as I said, the variety of job opportunities that are out there.
As you say, you're independent of the GAA itself, but your motto is "We are all supporters," and I presume you work closely with the GAA. And for instance, you'll get promotion in programs, and clubs themselves will be promoting what you're doing on a local level, just to try and make sure that this message is getting out to as many as possible. And it's interesting you use the phrase the GAA community. And if there was anything that sort of did embody the word community, surely it's the GAA.
Absolutely. It's probably, as you mentioned earlier, there has been some communities right throughout the country, you could say, in some ways decimated by the removal of whether it's a post office or a bank. And the GAA club is very much still the focal point, that I suppose you could say the only focal point that is left in some rural towns and villages across the country. So I think, I suppose, from our side, we're really trying to place an emphasis that it's important to keep these GAA clubs active, keep people that are involved with these GAA clubs employed and living locally so that they survive. And certainly, as you say, albeit not official GAA, we are working closely with each of the county boards that we come into contact with. So the plan is to take the initiative nationwide. At the moment, we have launched in four counties, and our first port of call in each county is to work directly with the county board and with the local clubs, who thankfully to date have been really positive towards the initiative. As you say, it's in their best interests to keep people connected in the local community, and that will hopefully keep them active members of the GAA community as well.
If businesses that do have jobs want to get in touch, how can they do so?
They can check out gaaworks.ie, have a look through the website. They may also email us info@gaaworks.ie, and we have a presence on social media and all the usual platforms there as well.
Kevin Meehan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That's Kevin Meehan, Business Development Manager with the gaaworks.ie. That project hopefully will see more people stay in their own local areas, and hopefully it'll see more local people staying to play with their clubs, to play with their county, and like the rising tide, it'll lift all boats. Kevin, thanks very much indeed.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Excellent. That's Kevin there from GAAworks.ie, and that's the website to go to if you're a business that has something to promote, or indeed if you are seeking employment. That's the place where you can go as well. Now, I just want to take a look at some comments that were left over from issues we discussed yesterday. Our Monday focus was a discussion on over-the-counter medicine and specifically addiction to over-the-counter medicine. And one caller says, it's doctors that need to be educated. It's very hard to get a doctor's appointment nowadays. And when you do, sometimes they think nothing of handing out big boxes of pain medication. And that may include Solpadeine and similar drugs that can be difficult. You can still buy them over the counter in a pharmacy, but someone wondering, is the actions of doctors one of the issues here? Now, also a caller saying, we discussed the eviction ban, obviously. A caller says, the eviction ban was illegal, terrible, every landlord will sell and only the mega landlords will rent houses at top rents. That interview with the Fine Gael councillor was one-sided and a poor interview. By the way, I'm not a landlord. I think that the interview with the Fine Gael councillor that they're saying is that a person was a man and his wife and their children were taken from their rented home in the middle of the night, and they were thrown onto the street by a group of men who illegally went into their home at a time when an eviction ban is in place. This came without warning. This came without notice. As far as I can see on the face of it, every rule in letter as well as in spirit was broken. So if that interview came across as being critical of and condemnatory of what happened to that family in Bundoran, I don't have a problem with that. I'm sorry, but that is the situation. Now, I want to go to line one because there is a very important documentary coming up on TG Cahar. It's being broadcast tomorrow night. And Circa Nick Ohan is the producer. Circa, apologies for butchering your name, but a very good morning to you.
You're okay, no problem. They used to miss me on the roll call as well, so you're not the first person.
I would have been inclined to say Nick Ohan, but it's Nick Ohan, is it? Or it's Ohagan.
Ohagan. Ohagan. Yeah, so on this coming Wednesday, the second part to the documentary series, this is the third series of Maroon Our Mask, which goes out on TG Cahar at 9:30 on Wednesday. And in this documentary, we're looking at the story of the disappearance of Arlene Arkinson.
And that's for the older of our listeners, that's a story that we literally have been covering on this radio station for the guts of 30 years. She went missing in 1984, last seen attending a disco in Bundoran, or en route to Bundoran, and originally from Castledurg, not seen since, believed to have gone missing in Donegal. And it's one of those stories that is still as big a mystery now as it was on day one, even though there have been various theories and people questioned and so on and so forth. We still don't know the truth.
Yeah, well, I suppose in some parts of the truth emerged or were sealed, I suppose. And on the 21st of July in 2021, at an inquest from the coroner, a coroner's inquest finally concluded. And with that conclusion, the coroner, Brian Sherrod, reported in his findings that Robert Howard had killed or had murdered Arlene, likely she was likely sexually assaulted as well, and that her body was likely to be in and around the Castledurg area. So that kind of put to bed a lot of rumours that had been, and suspicions that had been wrongfully in circulating in the early days of the investigation, and these rumours had kind of brought attention to the Arkinson family themselves, yeah, and had even, kind of wrongly implicated Kathleen Arkinson and her partner, yeah, in the disappearance of Arlene at the time.
I was actually there on the day that officers of what was then the RUC actually started digging up Kathleen Arkinson's garden, and I was there on the day. And I spoke, actually that day, I spoke to Arlene's father. And the question Arlene's father was asking on that day was, what about Robert Howard? What about Robert Howard? So that the first time I heard the name Robert Howard actually was from Arlene Arkinson's father on the day that the RUC were actually digging up her sister's garden.
Wow. Yeah, but it's crazy. Like, if I mean, eight. When you think about it now, you know, you're a family who's, you know, for Kathleen Arkinson, this was her 15-year-old sister who had just turned 15 that April, and so she was a child, and you know, she's missing. They were, their mother had died when Arlene was 11, so the family was already kind of upheaved in some ways, you know, you're struggling with grief and you're struggling to find answers of where your younger sister is. And then the police come knocking on your door and dig deep down into your back garden, eight feet deep, in your back garden. And, you know, I don't know how, like, what surprises me time and time again is the strength of Kathleen Arkinson to be able to continue and to be able to continue to try and find answers and try and find her sister's remains. And the hope that the family have now, I suppose, is, you know, for any information that might be out there, you know, as little or as small as one might think it may be, that could help in them finding Arlene's remains in order for them to have a burial, a proper Christian burial, as the Arkinson family's wishes are, and that she might be placed in the same grave alongside her mother and alongside her father, who's now deceased.
Yeah, and as you said, the ruling that Robert Howard was responsible for her death came from an inquest. It's an interesting one because it hasn't come from a court of law. What's the legal standing of that finding in terms of the law? Because it's something that I'm not 100% clear on, to be absolutely honest. I mean, is it a presumption or is that taken as a legal decision in the same way that a court decision would? I believe it may be slightly different.
It is slightly different as far as I understand, and I'm always with this case, I'm so cautious in terms of the legalities that surround it. But as far as I understand, you know, it's the what and the how and not the why.
Yeah.
So we know the inquest can conclude who has done this. And where, I suppose, they have done it or where the crime has happened, but they don't give us the a jury hearing that happened in 2015. I'm almost trying to 2005. This case goes on for so many years. It was 14 years going through the inquest. Proceedings. So in 2005, there was actually a court hearing of Robert Howard, and a jury found him not guilty of murdering Arlene Arkinson. But that jury was unaware that Robert Howard was, in fact, serving life imprisonment at the time for the murder of another 14-year-old girl in Deptford in southeast London. There had been a blanket so the jury wasn't aware of that crime and his imprisonment at that time, and they were also unaware of his previous crimes. Now, Robert Howard was a man who had had kind of a vast history of offences dating back as far back as the 1960s, all the way up to 2003, when he's finally arrested for the killing of the 14-year-old girl in Deptford. And, you know, it baffles me, I suppose, how he was able to get away with it for so long. And one thing that frightens me and kind of dawned on me halfway through while we were making this, or halfway through researching into Robert Howard, was that in fact we don't really know how many victims Robert Howard affected or had, and we probably will never know how many victims fell before Robert Howard.
Yeah, and it's the real tragedy of this case, as you say, is we did subsequently get that ruling at inquest, as you say, that the coroner ruled that Robert Howard was responsible for Arlene's death, but we're still using phrases like her body is probably buried in Castle Derga, and the bottom line is we still do not have a body. The family, Kathleen in particular, still do not have somewhere where they can focus their grief. And Arlene's father, and you know, he was a very passionate and upset man, obviously, over the course of all this, that he died not knowing, and that's always one of the going to be the, yeah, one of the terrible yeah things about this particular case.
I think the hardest thing, and throughout the series, so this episode is part of a 4-part series that airs every Wednesday night, and this is the third series of this programme. And throughout the making of these programmes, we work directly with the victims' families, or you know, close where the families aren't available. There's close friends, and it's always with the family's consent as well, which is important to say. But what I do notice is that, you know, families are left behind when their loved one gets murdered, and they're left behind to navigate, you know, their grief, and also the legal system, also trying to understand, I suppose, the shock and the trauma of a sudden violent death, which leaves a lasting effect on the family members, and oftentimes we find that, you know, their grief is so prolonged, and like at the end of the day, Arlene Arkinson was a 15-year-old girl, and she was on her way to a disco. You know, she was hoping that she would be able to go back to school at the end of summer. She was interested in art, and you know, she was deciding, I suppose, and planning in her head, you know, what her future might hold, or what might be in store for her. And you know, she didn't come home that night. And you know, I know there's countless parents or countless people out there who, you know, every time their children go out the door to the school disco, and if they don't get that text, you know, to say that they're on their way home, or if they don't, you know, hear the key and the lock at a certain time, you know, their anxiety is heightened. But that anxiety for the Arkinson family has prolonged for close to 30 years. It'll be 30 years next year that Arlene still hasn't walked through that door. And I suppose now they have kind of, they know that it's remains that they're looking for, that it no longer is, you know, Arlene is no longer going to walk through that door. But like, you know, if there was anybody at all who has any little bit of information that, you know, whatever their role might have been, or, you know, they might not have had a big role at all, but it could be something that might help. It could be something, you know, in the back of somebody's memory from that time that felt a bit odd for them or felt a bit wrong, you know, that could indicate in any way where Arlene might be.
Circa, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. That programme on 9:30 tomorrow night on TG Cahir. It's looking at the murder of Arlene Arkinson in 1984 from Castle Derg, had been going to a disco in Bundoran, 15 years of age, and as of now, her body still hasn't been found. Circa, go to Mahogath. That's Circa there. And it was a terrible story. And again, it's one of those stories that I first uttered the name Arlene Arkinson in terms of a story about a missing person who was last seen on Friday. And that's, it's one of those stories that, I mean, obviously it has been covered so much. And the name Robert Howard was a name that was in the ether right from the start. I mean, from the mid-1990s, we were aware of the name Robert Howard. He was subsequently, as Circa pointed out, he was found not guilty in a court of law, and then the coroner's inquest has ruled that the belief of the coroner is that Robert Howard was responsible for her death, and hopefully at some point we'll get closure for the family. Well, we've had a cloudy and damp morning so far, outbreaks of rain and drizzle. It'll brighten up though as the afternoon goes on, with sunny spells and showers developing. A blustery start with moderate to fresh and gusty south to southwest winds easing later. Mild though, temperatures will hit 12 to 15 degrees Celsius this afternoon, which is good. So we'll have a few showers, but we'll get some sunshine, and the temperatures will hit around 12. Hey, that's good. We can live with that. Now, you will be aware that Hamza Yousaf has been elected as the new leader of the Scottish National Party. He will go on to become Scotland's youngest First Minister. He will also be the first Muslim and member of an ethnic minority to be First Minister of Scotland. And I'm delighted to say I am now joined on Zoom by Niall Slater, who is a former Director of Learning and Teaching at the Open University. Niall, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You have obviously been keeping a close eye on what's been happening since the resignation of Nicola Sturgeon and the election yesterday of Hamza Yousaf. Is it today he officially becomes First Minister?
He's already officially the leader of the SNP, yeah. And I've forgotten whether it's today or it's very imminent anyway.
Yeah, I mean, he will be ratified once they sit in Holyrood. It'll be a formality. He will be ratified once Holyrood sits. You've obviously been keeping a close eye on what's been happening, and I'm sure you've been monitoring the election quite closely. This wasn't really a surprise. I mean, he was pretty much in the driver's seat, it was believed by many right from the off.
Well, it could have been Kate Forbes, and yeah. In fact, the result was very close. It was a bit like the Brexit vote in the UK. It was 48% for Kate Forbes and 52% for Hamza Yousaf. So that was actually very close, and it could have easily gone to her in the end.
In terms of Nicola Sturgeon, though, she had developed quite a reputation and quite a presence over the years. She's going to be a very hard act to follow.
Oh, absolutely. And Hamza Yousaf is young. He's 37 and relatively inexperienced, I suppose, in life. But he has been in the government for quite a long time. He's had a number of different jobs, Justice Secretary, Health Secretary. So he's got a fair bit of experience. Now, but there's no doubt that Sturgeon is going to be an extremely hard act to follow, yes.
As you say, he has been Health Minister now. Healthcare, as is the case in many places, here included, healthcare not in the best state. Health Minister, sometimes there was a former Health Minister here once described that position as the Angola of Irish politics. And I'm sure it's not all that much different in Holyrood.
Yes, I think that's right, especially with problems of not enough staff, as you've got in Ireland. The wages, salaries are not high enough, perhaps, to attract a lot of people. We've got immigration issues controlled by the UK government, so we can't actually get enough people in sometimes. And the budgets are not high enough, arguably. And the health of the population is not great in Scotland, with an ageing population as well. So we do need a lot of work in the health sector. The one of the problems for Scotland is that ultimately our budgets are really controlled by the UK government, and we don't have the ability to raise our own loans, government loans. So even if we wanted to improve the health a lot, we're kind of at the mercy of what is doled out to us by Westminster.
Nicola Sturgeon had the reputation of being someone that was listened to. And when she went to Westminster, she went to Westminster with an air of authority. She went to Westminster with an air of equality. And she went to Westminster and sat down and looked successive British prime ministers in the eye and said, I have a message for you and I'm going to deliver it to you. And I'm going to deliver it to you as an equal. And she very much had that sense of authority in her dealings with PMs and others. Is Hamza Yousaf going to have any difficulty getting that same sense of authority, getting that same sense of presence?
I think he will initially, because despite having been in government for quite a few years now, he's still a bit of an unknown quantity. First Minister's question time, which happens every week in Scottish Parliament, is a pretty ruthless business, and I don't know how he's going to stand up to that exactly, to the questioning that he's going to get from the Conservative members in particular. So especially because the record of health hasn't been perhaps as great as it might have been, he's going to be hammered every week on the what he's done in the past. So whether he'll be able to stand up to Rishi Sunak and some of the other people he's going to come into contact with, I don't know. He's apparently got a reputation as a nice guy. And I think that's why the Green Party is prepared to work with him, but also because of his more progressive views than the other candidates. So things like LGBT rights, the trans issue that we've had a lot of discussion of recently in Scotland, he's pretty much on the more liberal left-wing side of those debates. So he will come into a lot of conflict with the more conservative, more right-wing elements in the UK government. And how you stand up to that, I think, remains to be seen. Because being nice is a great thing, but it's not necessarily the quality that's going to get you the credibility to lead a country.
Finally, in terms of independence, Nicola Sturgeon had made it quite clear she was seeking another independence referendum and was not going to take no for an answer. Will Humza Yousaf pursue that with the same vigour and with the same sense of purpose that she did?
I think he'll have to, because he's in the leadership of the Scottish National Party. That's the raison d'etre of the SNP, is to go for independence. And if he's going to keep the membership on board, he's going to have to do something about that. But whether he'll manage to, I don't know. I mean, we're in this absurd position now in Scotland of having to ask the UK government if we can please have a referendum to find out if we want to be independent or not. And of course, the UK government is saying no. So about half the Scottish people seem to want independence and the other half are not convinced. And I don't know how we actually move forward on that and what Humza Yousaf's plans are to do that.
It's been a pleasure, Neil. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the programme this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Neil there speaking to us. Neil Slater, former Director of Learning and Teaching at the Open University in Scotland.